All right, so good evening. Happy Halloween. So this month I'm going to be looking at the paramis as a summary, kind of looking at them as a whole. So we spent the last 10 months going through each one, month by month, exploring them in some depth. And so now let's see how we can integrate them and see how they fit together. And next month, Tuareg will be talking about how to live the paramis. So these paramis, it's important to realize that they're a later addition to the whole Buddhist teachings, to the Pali Canon. So the original suttas of the Buddha, original words of the Buddha, are kind of this core set, and this is came a little bit later. And some people speculate that followers of the Buddha were looking and saying, well, how did he get to where he did? You know, what was about him that allowed him to become the Buddha? And so these 10 qualities were deemed to be what allowed him to really attain that deep awakening. Different traditions in Buddhism have different lists of the paramis, different numbers. In Theravadin we have these 10. So generosity, ethics, renunciation, wisdom, energy, patience, truthfulness, resolve, kindness, and equanimity. Right, so these 10. And each of these 10 are mentioned many times in the suttas, but never quite as a whole list. That came again a little bit later in the development of this tradition. Now, I don't know about your brain, but when I look at a list of 10, it's really hard to hold them all together. It's hard to kind of keep my mind focused on that. I think I read we can only hold about 7 things in our mind at once, and 5 is better, even 3 is the best. So I thought tonight we would look at these and divide them into groups, to 3 groups, kind of cluster them together. And this is just one offering of how to... how they might work together. You know, there's many different ways we could kind of form them together, but this hopefully might be helpful for us to get a handle on it. So the 3 groups, one is external actions, or you can say external expressions of our practice, how we interface with the world. Right? So these, I put generosity, ethics, truthfulness, and renunciation. So these 4 I was seeing as a way of relating to the world, how we actually show up outside of our internal experience. The second one is this internal actions or internal behaviors or qualities, including energy, perseverance, or resolve, and patience. I should say energy, patience, and resolve. So these 3 internal qualities are, you know, what shape how we practice, shapes how our understanding forms into our external actions. And so finally, these overarching qualities of wisdom, of metta, or loving kindness, and also equanimity. So together, these 3 categories show us from our wisdom, our understanding, naturally we have an action outward, and it was also an inward action. And these are all interrelated. They all support each other and feed upon each other. And they're certainly not an absolute list. Now, one thing as you look at that list of the 10 paramis, something stands out as missing. Right? And that's mindfulness. Have you noticed that? Mindfulness, concentration, investigation. These 3 factors show up in many of the other lists, like the Eightfold Path and the Factors of Awakening and the 5 Powers. All these lists have mindfulness in them, but the paramis do not. And I found that rather interesting. You know, why is that? Why isn't mindfulness in this list? Because it's such an essential part of how we practice this tradition here in the West. And when we come and the main focal thing is practicing, is learning to meditate, learning to relate to our experience in a particular way of non-judgmental, steady attention. Right? But this list doesn't include that. It also shows, because there's such a difference in our own Western practice and this list, it shows perhaps a little imbalance, that we emphasize the cultivation practices more than these other qualities. You know, we really like the idea of getting on the cushion and getting in there and getting to see ourselves in a different way. So it's a very self-focused practice, right? And so that certainly allows us to deepen. But if we don't take it out into the world in a transformational way, there's something out of balance. And that's something to consider, is how much of Buddhism do we just take as a narrow slice of meditation, of mindfulness, versus this whole other aspect. And the Paramis bring in these other aspects in a very nice way, of how we act in the world, how our attitude is in the world. You can almost say the Paramis are more the fruits of the practice, the expression of our practice. You know, as our practice deepens, we naturally start to become more generous. We start to become more ethical. Renunciation becomes more of a natural expression of our wisdom. And we start to develop more of a sense of energy, a sense of dedication toward our practice, while the practice itself is this cultivation. So these 10 paramis and these three groupings, again, are very interrelated. We could probably find many different ways to group them. This first grouping of external expressions or actions, again, the interface with the world. So generosity, morality or ethics, truthfulness, and renunciation. So these four aspects point to that our practice isn't in isolation. You know, it's in the context of our lives, our relationships, our overall culture, our society, the world. And if our practice is just narrowly something we do for the half hour or 40 minutes a day, it has very limited value. So these four show us how the practice manifests in the world, how it actually shows up. Now, how we act in the world, how someone acts in the world, is often a better indication of how deep their practice is than simply a meditative state or meditative attainment. So it may have very deep insights, very, very deep realizations while we're practicing, but if we're not able to integrate that into ourselves, into our actions, to allow it to start to transform how we actually perceive in the world and how we act in the world, it doesn't quite have the same maturity, the same depth. So that's why this sense of integration is so essential. There needs to be an alignment with our understanding. I think often we perhaps forget that in our practice. We perhaps forget to see, you know, how much a practice does show us about the nature of suffering, about the nature of the release of that suffering. We see it very directly in this meditative practice. But then how does that translate into our daily lives? So there's one hand is our depth of practice shows up in our life if it's integrated. But there's this other side of working with it, you know, basically the fake it until you make it mode. So you, let's say you don't feel very generous, so you make it a practice of never passing up an opportunity to be generous. I remember Joseph Goldstein took this on as a practice, and he would say, okay, whenever I have an impulse to act generously, I'm going to follow through on it. And sometimes he was surprised about what he was, you know, giving away. He's like, I wasn't quite ready to get that, let that one go. Because the Buddha said that if you knew what I know about generosity, you would never let a day pass without expressing that, without acting on that generosity. So this quality of kind of faking it till I make it, we can make these four practices or four qualities a practice. We can work with our generosity. We can work with our sense of ethics, how we are with the five precepts, with truthfulness. You know, how do we actually speak the truth? How do we know what the truth is? And how do we speak it in a timely way that's beneficial? And then renunciation, you know, the sense of setting aside what's no longer helpful, helping us have a sense of really putting our energy behind our practice by choosing to release certain things and reinforcing other areas. And so this way, when we're practicing something that we haven't fully understood or is not really going through our system yet, it starts to work backwards. In other words, if you're practicing being generous, you have to start to look outside yourself. You have to start to have this sense of connecting with others. If you're starting to really look at how your behavior is in terms of the ethics, in terms of non-harm, you start to find your mind becomes quieter. The mind's not so agitated by all the worry, about all the concern about causing harm in the world. Because we always have these feedback loops that are constantly going. And we can continue with the feedback loop of which causes more greed, more hatred, more delusion, or a feedback loop that starts to lead to the release of that, and generosity, and renunciation, and kindness. See, often we start practicing from a place of scarcity, of not enoughness, maybe from fear, from a self-focus of, you know, how am I doing? Am I doing well enough? And then our actions naturally flow from that perspective. In Buddhism, we sometimes talk about the hungry ghost. And these creatures are portrayed as having very small mouths, very small throats, but huge bellies. And so no matter how much they eat, they can never satiate. There's this constant hunger at reaching out for more and more. So when that hungry ghost is active in us, these paramis tend to be very far away. Our actions are more based in the greed, the hatred, the delusion. It makes more sense to be unethical when that is your perspective. It makes more sense to lie, to not be so honest. And the renunciation is not so easily accessible. But yet when we stop being so self-focused, when we start to see that there's actually more than just this limited person, we naturally start to align ourselves with these paramis. We naturally start to find ourselves wanting to be generous, spontaneously generous, you know, of our time, of our energy, of our resources. And so these groups, this four set here, tends to work very much together. So generosity, this, again, giving of our resources, our energy. And this is in some ways a positive expression of our ethics, right? So instead of saying, okay, I'll refrain from causing harm, I'll refrain from taking that which is not freely given, to go a step forward that I will practice generosity, that I will give freely of my energy and my time. Ethics. We start to see the impact of our actions on others, you know, more and more clearly. I think this often starts with this growing sensitivity that we cultivate through meditation. That we're sitting, attending to our breaths, our body sensations. And we start to attend to the echoes, the dissonance that happens when we say something harshly, when we take something that's not freely offered, when we lash out. we start to see also the turbulence in our minds caused by that. We're always looking over our shoulders and wondering, am I going to get in trouble? And as that starts, as our ethics start to become more and more aligned with our heart, we naturally become quieter. We actually become more settled in our being. There's less chatter, less worry. The Buddha talked about the five precepts, practicing those as having a limitless, a boundless benefit for yourself and for all beings. There's a power of these ethics. We can also say ethics are an expression of renunciation. That willingness to set aside our hungry ghost and not take, which is not freely given, not to lash out and harm, not to speak falsehoods. So generosity, ethics, and then truthfulness, speaking the truth. So truthfulness is such an interesting sense, especially these days with all the takes on what's true. It's a little staggering. But this essential alignment with what is true, and this essential expression through our words with what is true. Remember, my wife was teaching in an environment, and one student really kind of got caught in telling lies and would tell these stories, very elaborate stories, and then they would have a meeting and she would have to remember her old stories and add more story to it. And you could see this whole juggling act was starting to fall apart for this poor person. You know, and so much internal noise and fear around that. So we start to find that the truth matters much more than our defensiveness, than our need to protect ourselves. And we all have that sense of when you know something is true, we may not like that truth. We may not want to say it. We may not want to admit it. But we feel we can't escape that sense of alignment, that sense of knowing. And the more we practice, the clearer that alignment becomes. And also the more dissonant it is when it's not aligned. It's like if you practice an instrument and you know, when you first start and you're kind of not quite, you're a little tone deaf, but as your ear becomes more and more refined, you can tell when it's just slightly out of tune and it's very irritating. And that's the same thing with the sense of truth. Because it's not quite lined up here. Right? Ruth Denison said that you can't, when you practice, after you've practiced for a while, you can't get away with anything. Right? And she meant, I believe, internally. And you can't fool yourself anymore. You can't go into rationalization and talk yourself out of it. You know what's true. You just know that. And this is also a positive expression of ethics, speaking truthfulness. And the fourth one in this group here is renunciation. Renunciation. Often what we're renouncing are actions which are based in fear and anger and hatred and delusion. So these deep roots that John's going to talk about on Friday really form so much of the harm in life. Right? And we start to see that in both in the very overt ways and also the more and more subtle ways that we cause just subtle contractions, subtle harm in our actions. And so renunciation has an expression of setting that aside, to be willing to, okay, I'm not going to do this. And so generosity, ethics, and truthfulness can all be expressions of this renunciation when I'm choosing to speak the truth, when I'm choosing to give of my time, follow ethics. So these four external qualities of generosity, of ethics, of truthfulness, and renunciation, these are all informed and shaped by the internal factors and also these more wisdom factors. So this separation is really, it's just kind of, in some ways, arbitrary. And it can be helpful to separate them out a little bit. But really, they all are so integrated that these internal qualities fuel how we are externally. And as our external expression of our practice becomes more and more aligned, we naturally feel quieter inside. There's more stillness, which gives us more confidence in the practice. That stillness allows even a deeper seeing. So let's move on to the second quality, or second group. So that was the external group, external actions. And here's the internal actions, internal qualities or behaviors of energy, of patience, and resolve. So energy, patience, and resolve. So practicing the Dharma is often said like swimming, it's like swimming upstream against a strong current, the current of our society, of our culture. And you often feel that, especially here, maybe everyone feels that in whatever culture they're in. But there's so much input to, if you buy this, you'll feel happy. If you get rid of this thing, then you'll feel happy. There's so much greed, hatred, and delusion that just embedded in our culture. And they all have a very strong momentum and reinforcement, right? You know, you get a nice car, someone says, oh, that's a nice car. You know, that sense of reinforcing this whole past process, this whole pattern. Again, from very gross levels, very obvious levels, to very subtle, moment by moment arising of that. Yet the saving graces, they all create suffering. They all create a quality of suffering. And that suffering tends to wake us up, to look more closely, to question those strategies. So these three paramis of energy, impatience, and resolve, these help to really come into bear, to give us energy to go upstream, to be willing to challenge some of the assumptions we have in our culture, in our upbringing. On the retreat, we were just did a cloud mountain. I was using this analogy of a small fire that, you know, each one of us has a spark, and we're blowing on that spark and trying to get it to blaze and come alive. Right? So these three paramis help bring that quality of spark, that quality of fuel. So first one is energy, also called diligence or rigor or effort. And it can be motivated by suffering. And we start to see, by doing this course of action, this course of thought, I have more suffering. I have more dis-ease. So that can be a very important motivator. Sometimes we're motivated more by just wanting to see deeply, to see, is there something more than this? Can I see this sense of interconnection, not as a theory, but as a direct experience? So these help to overpower our desire to stay asleep, to stay disconnected. So energy. Now patience, also tolerance, forbearance, acceptance, endurance. This is an interesting paradox. With energy, there's this kind of upward leaning motion, this energy to really look, to really be present, to practice, even when it's difficult. Now, patience is this counterbalancing, because often our will has this sense that, okay, if I really put my effort to it, I can get there right away. Right? But there's so much momentum that we have to have this deep sense of patience, this willingness to come back again and again. You know, coming back to the breath again and again. And with patience, each one of these, you could say there's like a near enemy, and patience could be a sense of endurance, a sense of toughing this out until I get through this. But true patience, it's like time kind of gets suspended. The sense of having, there's a future, there's a past, there's just, this is the moment that I'm meeting. And often when we're not patient, we think, oh, am I having this again? I thought I was through with this. I thought I had already dealt with this, and it's coming up again. And it's that willingness to say, okay, let me meet you again. Like a song says, hello, heartache. And please have a seat. It's good to see you again. That sense of welcoming this again and again. The Buddha, you know, there's tremendous projection, of course, on who the Buddha was and what he was able to do. But one of the some of the suttas, it's interesting that after his awakening, that Mara keeps showing up. So Mara is the impersonification of delusion, of confusion, of greed and hatred. And so that was kind of what the Buddha really came against and was able to see through and to release. But after he had this deep, very deep, profound awakening, for years after, the suttas would have Mara come back up again. And Mara would be trying to trick him and confuse him. And he might be tricked for a little bit and says, oh, I see you, Mara. I see you. And so that quality of patience, even though you thought you were done with that painful pattern, that painful experience, and it comes up again. In that moment of meeting it is where patience arises. This is an internal relationship. This is what's arising. I'm meeting this. And the final one in this little group is resolve. Resolve. This is a sense of full commitment, of an unwavering commitment. I remember Myoshin Kelly, when she was going through the teacher training, she made a resolve to practice an hour in the morning and an hour in the evening for 4 years. Right? And so she did that diligently. And then one day was her birthday, and you know, she went out with some friends and had a little wine and went to bed, and then realized she hadn't sat her second hour. So she got out of bed and sat. And she was, you know, falling asleep and very drowsy, but she sat for that whole time. And so that's a beautiful example of the power of resolve. That willingness to meet, you know, to maybe have a commitment. And also, I think the resolve in particular is willing to meet experience from our deepest wisdom, from our deepest understanding. I think that's one of the most profound resolves. It's not to move into ignorance, into contraction, when we know better. You know, there's many times we'll forget and get confused and not know, because our unconsciousness is kind of the leading edge there. But once we've seen something, to be willing not to continue to follow through on that, to follow down that that train of thought that leads to, you just know it doesn't lead to anything helpful. So these three internal qualities of patience, of resolve, of energy, these are really tested by our external actions, how we show up in the world, you know, how we speak, our truthfulness, our ethics, our sense of generosity. Our renunciation. I was forgetting the fourth one there for a second. Yeah. And how much resolve do we have to speak the truth? We may really resolve strongly to do that, but we have to say something that you know it's not going to be well received, but you need to say it. You know, how does that alignment show up? So the final group, this is what I, for lack of a better word, are calling the overarching qualities. Okay, of wisdom, of metta, or loving kindness, and equanimity, upekkha. So these are like the internal actions of energy, patience, resolve, the external actions of generosity, of truthfulness, of renunciation and ethics. You know, these are all very much informed by these three qualities of our wisdom, our compassion. And so it becomes this feedback loop. right? As we have greater wisdom, greater kindness, more equanimity, we start to see that manifesting in our actions. We start to find we're naturally more generous, we're naturally more truthful and ethical. We also find this internal energy, these internal actions start to grow. We find ourselves with more energy, more interest in really practicing, because we're seeing how it's deepening. We see how it's leading to less and less suffering. Our resolve becomes stronger. And yet there's also a patience, because we realize from wisdom, moving into impatience is just moving into thought. So then this allows our actions to become more and more aligned, which creates greater stillness, which in turn allows greater seeing, which then allows deeper alignment. So you can see how the feedback loop can just continue to build and build. As our heart relaxes, our heart opens, again, the same feedback loop. Kindness starts to grow. Then kindness becomes a sense of a guiding factor, a sense of willingness, this deep alignment of wanting to connect with the heart and see what is kind in this moment, kind toward myself and kind to others. To quote the famous kindness poem, before you know how kindness is the deepest thing inside, you must know sorrow as the other deepest thing. You must wake up with sorrow. You must speak to it until your voice catches the thread of all sorrows and you see the size of the cloth. Then it is only kindness that makes sense anymore. Only kindness that makes sense anymore. This is the alignment of the paramis. As our practice deepens through meditation, through investigation, through concentration, there's a natural alignment with our actions. Only kindness makes sense. And then generosity, of course, is natural. Truthfulness is natural. Renunciation makes complete sense. Ethics, of course, makes sense. And there's an urgency internally to align more and more. So there's the energy that's there, there's this sense of resolve, and there's this deep patience. So these three, wisdom. So this is a path of direct seeing, of seeing for ourselves. Especially the way we practice here, it's not so based on faith, on taking someone's word for how things are. It's much more giving you the tools to see for yourself. And we may say, you might look that direction, might be helpful. But it's really that direct seeing. So instead of it being based on acquired knowledge, something that we might read and kind of borrow, it's really earned knowledge, earned wisdom. Now, kindness or metta. And metta is such an interesting parami. Christina was talking about this this sense of simply being next to, this willingness to be near something as the expression of metta. Because when we put the word love in there, our culture has so many kind of distortions around love. We have to have that sense of our heart feeling open. And this is an aspect of metta, but the essential part is this willingness to stand next to. And in that standing next to, there's also this expansion beyond the normal distinctions. And I think that's why we go through those different categories of benefactor, of self, of neutral person, of friend, of enemy. Applying metta to every category. If we keep doing that, we start to realize, well, how can metta be so different? Usually I think of these different categories as differently, but metta is something beyond that, that holds all beings equally. And then equanimity, upekkha, as I spoke about last month, is just simply being equally near to all things. this sense of seeing beyond the differences, the distinctions. So naturally, that equally near all things is the natural state. So these three overarching qualities of wisdom, of kindness, and of equanimity feedback and inform those internal actions and external actions, and they in turn deepen the wisdom, deepen the quality of heart, deepening the balance of the mind. So these three groups, these three ways of taking the paramis, and again the external expression or actions of generosity, of ethics, of truthfulness and renunciation, the internal qualities of energy, of patience, and of resolve, and these overarching qualities of wisdom, of loving kindness, and equanimity. You can see how interrelated and interconnected they are. I think a helpful way to look at these, you know, in summary again, is that these paramis are a way of kind of working backwards. What I mean by that is, you know, that term reverse engineering. When, you know, you get something and then you kind of figure out how do they make that. So they look at the Buddha and say, well, how would you be awakened? How would you be enlightened? What would your mind be like? What would your actions be like? And these ten paramis are what came up from that inquiry. That someone who's fully awakened will naturally have a heart of generosity, naturally have a heart of renunciation, you know, and so on. And so cultivating these ten qualities, it starts to teach us perhaps somewhat of the mind of the Buddha. The sense of how to be based in stillness and yet based in a deep heart of compassion. So let's just sit quietly for a moment or two. And as we sit, with each moment that arises, there's also an arising of your wisdom, of your heart. And letting that wisdom translate into action internally or externally. Can be an expression of these paramis. All right, thank you for your attention. I'll just say a few words about the practice and reflection for this week. So reflecting on the paramis and this particular grouping, you can see us try it out, see if it makes sense. These external actions, internal actions, overarching qualities, and just reflecting to see where am I strong in? Where is it naturally easy for me to be generous? And which areas are not so easy? And see what would it take, what quality needs to happen to start to bring them into balance. So they all have an equal balance. Because we do have a bias in our practice of focusing so much on the meditative qualities. This is a call to bring it out into the world. All right, so we have a chance for any comments or questions. Yes, Sir Lee. When, well, that's a good question. I didn't see the exact date. I'm not sure if there is an exact sense of that. It's in the Pali Canon, and it's. I almost wrote down the word because I thought someone might ask, but there's the main kind of basket of suttas, which include like the middle length discourses and long discourses, the connected discourses, the numerical discourses, and a couple other ones like the, I forget the name of that. There's a couple other ones which are all very much seem to be what the Buddha said, more or less. But then there's these other ones which are added on, like the Jataka tales and this particular one, which is basically relating the history of all the previous Buddhas. Yes.
Okay. So he didn't obviously comment on it, at least to our knowledge.
No, yeah, it doesn't seem like he did. I think that would have been captured in the suttas. So remember the history of Buddhism that, you know, the Buddha taught for 40 years, which is a long time for a spiritual teacher. When he died about 3 months later, they got all the senior students together and said, okay, let's codify what he had taught. You know, and the legend is that Ananda had this perfect memory of all these different suttas. Another student had a good memory of all the rules of conduct for the monks and nuns. And so they basically said, they all agreed upon, these are the suttas we want to maintain. And they would say, okay, this group over here is in charge of memorizing these ones and reciting them and passing them on to everybody else. And you guys do that group, and you do that group, and you do that group. And so for 300 years, it was all an oral tradition, right? And then it was, then in Sri Lanka, they wrote them, were able to write them down. But there, periodically, they would have these councils that would come together and reform, look at what they want to keep, maybe did some edits. And I believe at those times, they would add different things in. You know, that knowledge isn't coming up in my head right now, but it's there's like about seven or so is what comes to mind.
Did we take things out and add things?
I believe so.
Yeah.
And there's some of the early the scholars these days are trying to see what's the closest to the original stream, you know, looking at, you know, what went over to China and comparing that to these different translations, because there's wars that came in, there was, you know, things got wiped out, so there used to be quite a lot of different schools, and then Theravada is really the only one that remained out of, I think, around 13 different schools. But, you know, that's, so on one hand, it's really helpful to think about what did the Buddha actually teach. But if we just kept to that, we would throw out, you know, most of bookstores and most of teaching. So we also have to let the practice evolve and be informed. And it can be very helpful to have a context like the Paramis. So, yeah, just, I try to be careful about saying the Buddha said this only if I'm pretty sure that's what he said. And I'm probably wrong sometimes too. You're welcome. Yeah, Daniel.
tier, they all seem to, they seem to be interrelated and support each other or counterbalance each other.
Yep.
And the third set almost seems like there are three ways of talking about the same thing or naming the same thing.
Nice.
And that seems like they're not as distinct from each other as the first two sets are within themselves. Is that a fair?
Sounds great. So the comment was that the first two sets seem very interrelated, that they support each other, while the third set is almost expressions of the same quality. And I think that's a nice way to look at it. Yeah, that wisdom and loving kindness or metta and equanimity are aspects of the same quality. You know, sometimes there's the wisdom leading, sometimes the heart's leading, but they're both the same mechanism. And the other two are very related. I mean, you need to have energy to be able to bring up renunciation, or to energy to be ethical, to speak the truth, and patience when you fall down on that, and resolve to bring that sense of commitment. Yes, yeah, so they are very, those first two are very connected. Yeah.
Teacher, this teacher is more of a heart teacher. But when you listen to them, it seems like, well, I find it difficult to really make those distinctions. They seem of a piece.
Yeah, so the comment was, and just repeating it for the online, that some teachers, they're said to be more wisdom teachers, and some are more compassion teachers. But when you listen, they seem like they're really one and the same. And I think that's an important perspective, is that wisdom and compassion can't exist independently of each other. That you may have a gateway into the Dharma that's more wisdom-based, for example. You more like really want to see clearly and see impermanence and see anatta and all these different qualities. But unless compassion starts to come in to counterbalance that and to inform that, it only can go so far. And the same thing with compassion. There's a sense of that quivering of the heart in response to pain and this open-heartedness. It needs to have also the wisdom come in to bring that quality of equanimity, that sense of balance. So I think they are, I think the distinction is not so helpful to focus on. Yeah, so that's well said. The paramis are, there are a lot of them, so it's a little hard to kind of get a handle on them, but. All right, any other comments or questions? Okay, well, let's call that good then. And we have, do you have some announcements? So thank you.